Baseball tournament. NPR's Mike Pesca reports that the top seeds survived.
Though the University of North Carolina beat Creighton fairly easily, they suffered a big blow when their point guard, Kendall Marshall, broke his wrist in the second half. Carolina's next opponent will be Ohio, the 13th-seeded team in the Midwest region. The Athens-based school will join Ohio State, Xavier, and Cincinnati as one of four representatives from the Buckeye State among the 16 left playing. Two conferences, the Big East and Big Ten, account for half the schools in the Sweet 16. Though there are still games to be played in Phoenix, the tournament is of limited regional diversity. Since the tournament expanded to 16 teams in 1951, this is only the second time that the Sweet 16 doesn't include a team from the Mountain or Pacific time zone. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese.
In the new book, The Undead, science writer Dick Teresi examines how advanced medical technology is blurring the line between life and death. One example relates to the process of organ donation. We'll also talk with organ transplant surgeon Dr. Richard Freeman, professor and chair of the Dartmouth Medical School Department of Surgery. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. This hour of the program comes from the Focus Archive. It's a show we first broadcast in January, so that means during this hour, we'll not be taking calls. Almost everyone learns at least one language as a child. There are some people who may manage to learn two or three. But throughout history, there have been accounts of people that we might call language super learners. For example, Giuseppe Mezzofante. He was a 19th century Italian priest. He was, in fact, a cardinal in the Roman Catholic Church. And it was said that he could speak upwards of 40 languages. Some accounts say that he could speak even more. So here's the question. Could such a feat actually have been possible? And is there anyone alive today who could match that? Well, in this hour, we'll be talking with Michael Erard. He is the author of a book that has recently come out. And the title of his book is Babel No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. And it is indeed about a search that he made to determine whether, in fact, there are people living today like Giuseppe Mezzofante who could speak 20, 30 languages, more perhaps. The book is published by the Free Press. It's recently come out. Our guest, Michael Erard, has graduate degrees in linguistics and rhetoric from UT Austin, and he has written about language and linguists and linguistics for a number of publications, among them Science, Slate, Wired, Atlantic, New York Times, New Scientists, and others. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Michael Erard, hello.
Hi there, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
We appreciate it. Sure. Well, let me just, I think a good way to start would be to ask you to talk a little bit more about this man, Cardinal Giuseppe Mezzofante. Who was he?
Well, he's the person who, when you start talking about language super learners, like you called them, or hyperpolyglots, that the conversation really starts. He is the sort of primo language learning myth. In the 19th century, when people thought of a massive multilingual, they thought of him. He was born in Bologna in 1774. He died in Rome in 1849 and really didn't travel very much outside of those places. But because of his language learning interests and his talents, and also the fact that he worked for a time as a librarian, he was able to amass knowledge in a number of languages. And as you pointed out in your intro, an exact number is elusive, but clearly he was doing quite a lot of things in quite a lot of languages to a very high degree.
Mm. And apparently there are accounts of people who wanted to test him, to test his skill, and doing things like, assembling a group of individuals who were native speakers of different languages and sort of tossed them in a room with the cardinal just to see how he could handle it. And the accounts are, in fact, that he could just go from one person to another and engage them in conversation in their native tongue.
Yeah, and switch from language to language. That's one of the amazing things about Metsafanti. And there were a number of really incredible things that he could do or that he was reported doing. But this switching from language to language is one of the most interesting ones because among people who are multilinguals, and I want to say more ordinary multilinguals, though they're not really ordinary, but you know, people who speak five or six languages, what's happening in the brain is that all of those people, that they're activating all of those languages in their brain at the same time, and then they are suppressing the languages that they don't want to use, that they're not going to speak. And so the question, one question is, you know, was Metsafanti actually activating in his brain all 30, 40 languages and then selectively, very quickly, and without any reported errors, switch from language to language, able to suppress those ones that he didn't want? That's one of the things that's incredible about him.
And you think that, at least based upon the accounts and the stories about Metsafanti, that, I think he said some point that maybe he spoke 70 languages or something. But even if we're making a conservative estimate and we say, well, maybe he only spoke 40, that just seems it beggars, you know, the imagination that someone could actually do that.
Yeah, you know, so some things to keep in mind. One, he started when he was very young. He found himself in a classroom when he was 3 or 4 years old, and it was kind of a daycare situation, but it turned out that he was actually paying attention. So he was incorporated, his formal education started at that point, where he was given access to Latin and ancient Greek. And he also had some teachers when he was elementary age, who probably introduced him to a number of languages as well. You know, as a priest, he wouldn't have had a family to take care of, although he did take care of his own parents and his nieces and nephews. But he had a lot of time to devote to this. And then what was interesting was, you know, he was someone who we think of, you meet someone who doesn't speak your language, that's, we kind of call that a language barrier. For him, that was an opportunity. So he would go to hotels and ask if there were foreign visitors, and he would try to talk to them. There were a number of occasions where there were some battles that were taking place in and around Bologna, and the hospitals were filled with people from all over the Austrian Empire that spoke a bunch of different languages, and he would go and minister to them and nurse, and in the process of doing that, he was picking up a lot of languages too. And then he became famous for doing this, and so he kind of became the linguistics crossroads, you know. And one of the things that I got to see when I went to his archive in Bologna were all of the little visiting cards that he received from people. I mean, just dozens and dozens and dozens of these things from people from all over the world, you know, Russian princesses and Texan colonels. And these were people who would come and visit him. He was famous for being somebody who spoke a lot of languages. And in so doing, he got practice speaking a bunch of different languages as well. So that's kind of the world that he lived in.
I'm sure that throughout history there have been accounts of people, other people who have really strong language proficiency, particularly in reading them. Maybe speaking them is another thing, but I suppose that there would have been times when to be a scholar, it would be necessary for you to have command over a number of languages, certainly Latin and Greek to start, and then a number of others. But it does also seem that if in fact it have been left behind about the cardinal are true, there can't have been too many people ever who would have been his equal.
About him is maybe so, maybe not. He also had the benefit of quite a large institution behind him that was very interested in forwarding his reputation, which was the Catholic Church, written in 1859, is as much an attempt to try to get past the myth and ascertain something real about him. It's also a hagiography. And it could also be an argument for making Metsafanti a saint, one of the documents that I found in the archive in Bologna was this legal document about the disinterment of his body in 1885. There had been rumors that that there were foreigners who were trying to get a hold of his skull, and they were worried that grave robbers might come. His family had actually been approached, sell parts of his body, so they went and they dug him up. Also, interestingly, that it would be the first step in the canonization process to make sure that the body of the venerable whole and was not being venerated by a group that was not sanctioned by the church.
I'm sure that that today, and there would have been other times as well, we could have found places where people who were native speakers of a number of individuals who were native speakers of a particular language were thrown together, and as a means of survival, that they had to be able to talk to one another. So we'd have examples where people would pick up they would be functionally multilingual. That is, they could get along and they could talk with other people who spoke other languages. But so that's sort of one thing, and we can talk about that. But this other thing, the polyglot is the word for someone who speaks a whole bunch of languages. Well, the hyper polyglot, someone who could speak upwards of 10. Now that's a different thing from someone who is functionally multilingual.
It depends on the setting, I think, and it depends on what those people do in their lives. I think what you're saying is, in situations, say, in the American, in the Caribbean, where you had pigeons and creoles arise, that lots of people sort of cobbled together a language, a common language from a lot of different inputs. The hyperpolyglots really do, interestingly, seem to keep their languages separate from each other. I only ever talked to someone, to any of the living hyperpolyglots that I met, in English, and because I only speak English. But even their English seemed to be untouched by the fact that they knew so many other languages. Certainly, they had lots of other things in their lives, and one person was, they were also multilingual. They were also using things in their lives. One gentleman that I read about in the book and spent a lot of time with lived in Berkeley. He was married to a Korean woman, so he spoke Korean. He also spoke French to his children and spent a lot of time with Chinese. He had lived in Korea and also in Lebanon, so he was using Arabic on a daily basis as well. Now he lives in Singapore. So this is all just kind of a part of his life and the way that he leads it. But his English, interestingly, seems to be untouched. He doesn't switch back and forth between languages in the way that we might think that bilinguals or multilinguals would tend to do. I find that thing sort of very interesting about them. And in that sense, the hyperpolyglots, one of the ways that they're different from multilinguals is, that the hyperpolyglots, they're not really shaping the languages that they speak in a way. They're not participating in the future of the language. They're really receiving the language as it is and attempting to use it in a particular way. But you can think of those creators of pigeons and creoles as, shaping all of this linguistic stuff, all of this linguistic systems for future use and for future generations. And the hyperpolyglot just doesn't extend into the future like that.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour for anyone who might have just tuned in the past couple of minutes. Michael Erard has written about language, linguistics, and linguists for many publications, Science, Slate, Wired, Atlantic, New York Times, New Scientist. He is the author of the recent book, Babel No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. It's published by the Free Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email also is possible, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we talked about this man who is the saint, both literally and figuratively, I guess, of the hyper polyglots, this legendary, although he was a real guy, Cardinal Mezzofonte. So your idea, and really a lot of what the book is about, a good part of what the book is about, is well, could you go out today and find a living person who would be something like, maybe not in the scope of the languages that they could speak, but somebody like Cardinal Mezzofonte?
Yeah, the book really started for me with that question of who is the world's most lingual person? So who's the person who speaks the most languages or who knows the most languages in the world? And how would you ascertain that to be true about them? And I think also what language would you speak to them in? Where would you find them? Where would you expect them to be? And what kind of person would you expect them to be as well? And so the book really starts from that notion that there could be someone out there who has this ability, and it's my attempt to find that person. And I start with Mezzofonte, and that's a really good place to raise a lot of questions about, well, what does it mean to speak a language? What were the standards that were applied to Mezzofonte in his time that maybe would be different in the early 21st century that would shape someone's ambitions for their foreign language learning? What is the science that might explain what that person is able to do with their brains, and so forth? And at the end of the book, I do arrive at someone who I will call the world's most lingual person. And his name is Derek Herning, and he's a church organist. He's Scottish, and he lives on the Shetland Islands. And the reason that he, you know, I sort of give this title to him is because, one, his skills are in oral language, so he's not translating or reading these languages, although he does some of that work. He's also been tested in all of his languages in the same window of time. So in 1990, there was a contest in a little town near Brussels, where all of these hyperpolyglots met and competed against each other. And Herning was the one who was given points for having competence in 22 languages, although he knew some other languages. And after the contest, he was in his 50s, I think, during the contest, and he then went on to acquire some others. So this is someone who, when he says that he, you know, has a number of languages, it's not just him reporting that. It's something that was actually tested with real native speakers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets at, I'm sure, what is a critical question, and that is, how do you measure fluency? And, you know, you could have someone who perhaps could talk with a number of people and say things like, "Hi, how are you? Lovely day, isn't it? Can you direct me to the library?" But there's there does that really constitute competence in that language? And how detailed, how sophisticated a conversation do you have to be able to have with someone for you to be considered to be competent in that language?
So the notion, I think there's a notion that, you know, this mythic figure of the hyperpolyglot is someone who is perfectly proficient in all of these languages, that in each language they speak it like a native. And there turns out to be quite a patchwork of proficiency, I call it. Mezzofonte had a patchwork. Some languages he was very, very good in, and some languages he just had the rote lines, like you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. What happened in this contest that Derek Herning participated in, the judges were instructed to give people award points based on someone's performance in exactly those ways. So someone who just seemed to have a few sentences, they wouldn't get very many points. Someone who could respond to really sophisticated questions and talk in paragraphs and sound, have a really good accent and not make a lot of mistakes when they spoke, they were given more points. So there were two ways to win the contest, in a sense. You could have a lot of points in a few languages, or you could get a few points in a large number of languages. In that contest, interestingly, there were style points that were awarded. So people who had a wide array of languages across language families, judges could give them a set of points. You know, and that's those two things together is how Herning won that contest, through style points and through having a fair amount of proficiency in a lot of languages.
Mm-hmm. There are languages end up getting grouped into families because they're related, and certainly there are some languages where there are enough cognates so that, you know, you could imagine that maybe it would be conceivable that someone would have a reasonably good command of, say, French, Spanish, and Italian. And that maybe you could also then imagine, you know, tossing in a few other things. So maybe you could have someone who had pretty good facility in European languages, and particularly in the Romance languages.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it starts to be harder if you start to think about, well, can you imagine a person who was competent in a number of languages, but there were languages that were completely unrelated, you know, someone who could speak Russian and Mandarin and Finnish and Urdu and, you know, pick your exotic, we'll put together a collection of exotic, unrelated, difficult languages. Can you imagine someone being able to do that as well as somebody who could really be fluent, say, in a number of European languages?
Yeah, the question of repertoire is really interesting. Mezzofanti's languages spanned 11 different language families. I think Derek Herning's languages span 4 or 5 families. I think there's someone I met locally near where I live. His languages are interesting because they are not typical, they're not national languages. They're a group of Native American languages and some more minority languages from Asia. He does speak some national languages like Indonesian and Mandarin, but it's a very diverse and disparate set of languages. So, you know, the people who, like you said, who know languages that come from the same family, they do have that advantage in the cognates. What can be difficult about speaking those languages is that I was talking before about the simultaneous activation and suppression of languages. If the languages are very similar, it becomes harder to suppress the unwanted languages because your brain has to sort out which representation of sounds belongs to which language. So it's not always an advantage, right? And the disparateness of the different languages that people speak is not always a disadvantage, because what you're doing there is you're getting a very wide survey of all of the different structures that languages could have. So each new language that you find, you can generally know what to expect. Okay, if it has this structure, then it's probably going to do this thing and that thing. And then learning the language then becomes, in some sense, a process of experimentation, making hypothesis, okay, I bet it's going to do this, and then finding out, aha, it does. So some of these learners have that sense of excitement about finding out that their prediction about a language structure is like what they thought.
Well, that gets at this. There are a lot of interesting questions, obviously, here. If you find someone who has this ability, then the question is, well, what's really going on here? And is it that this person has a great insight into the structure of languages, and so their ability to learn a language and to speak it is somehow strategic in that sense, or whether there is something just in the way that their brains are wired up, possibly something that, you know, if you scanned them, you could see, or if you could, you know, when they'd passed, you could take a look at their brains and you could see something in there and you could say, well, I can actually point to some structures here or something in the person's brain that's different. That maybe has to do with the centers where language are. And so we could say that it's not just that this person was maybe maybe just smarter about language, they actually were organically different than the rest of us.
And that's a fascinating question, and that brings the book and brings us right to the cutting edge and really to the edge of what anybody knows about this, and not only language learning, but lots of different kinds of learning. I was fortunate enough to be able to see the sections of the brain of a German diplomat named Emil Krebs, who died in 1930. He spoke and could work with 68 languages. He's also given more languages. When he died, his brain was donated by his family to a collection of elite brains in Dusseldorf, Germany, and it was analyzed by two German neuroscientists about 10 years ago using some technology to map the structure of his cortex in the language areas, and they compared his brain with the brain with the brains of normal people and or controls, and they found a number of unusual patterns to his brain development. Now, use of the brain leads to overdevelopment in certain areas. So practice, you know, the brain is the plasticity of the brain, it responds to practice, experience, and to use. The question is, was his brain somehow more plastic? Was it able to retain a plasticity from an earlier age which other people lose as they enter adulthood? And that's a really interesting question, and there's no clear answer to that quite yet. There have been a number of other studies with some other figures, with some other research subjects, and in some other areas, including music, that suggest that people who are high performers, they do have, there is something organically about their brain that allows them, that enables this kind of learning. I say that the hyperpolyglots, they're not born and they're not made, but they're born to be made. These are people who have a neurological hardware that's specifically suited for learning language quickly and learning and using a lot of languages. And they might have this ability in their brains, but not everyone gets access to the materials, and not everyone lives in an environment where they can actually exercise this this neurology. And part of my argument in the book is that the globalization of the world is basically creating a set of environments in which people who possess this kind of hyperpolyglot neurology are being selected for and are being enabled and are being fed, and that we will probably be seeing more and more of these types of people.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge, and the guest is Michael Erard. He writes about language, has written about language for many publications, Science, Slate, Wired, Atlantic, New York Times, and is the author of the new book, Babel No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners. It's published by the Free Press. We have somebody here in the nearby community of Belgium, not the country, but the town. Line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning.
Yes.
Hi.
My question, and actually, I'm sorry, you haven't mentioned whether you're a polyglot or not. I know I'm not, but I do know a person who is at least totally fluent in both Mandarin and English. And I notice when she speaks, she can go back and forth between both languages immediately, without hesitation. And she has no accent that I can find in English. I don't know about Mandarin, because obviously I don't speak it. But the question I have about what you're talking about is, now, do you think in one language? Do you automatically translate? Or are you so knowledgeable that it just doesn't need translation?
Yeah. So I think in the first part of your question, you asked if I am a polyglot, and I am not. I call myself a monolingual with benefits. I basically speak English, although I've studied Spanish and Chinese in the past, but, you know, don't ask me to say anything on the radio, please. As to the other question, you know, do we think, or how is it that she's able to think in the two languages so fluidly and so proficiently? Part of the answer is that we don't think in any language, that the language, you know, any given human language is a way that we sort of translate the activity of our brain to the outside social world. And so what she has is basically two translation systems between the activity in our brain and the rest of the world. Is that getting at your question?
Exactly, sir. Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. There have been at least there's one guy that you write about in the book in this quest to find somebody who would truly be a super a hyper polyglot or a super learner. At least people who have made the claim and then found out, well, maybe not quite. And maybe the example there, the one that I think of, is this man, Ziad Faza, who at one time was listed in the Guinness Book of World Records. And then it turned out, well, maybe that wasn't quite right.
Yeah, so in the early 90s, the Guinness Book of World Records got itself into the business of certifying people as great polyglots or hyperpolyglots, although they didn't use that word. The title they were giving was the world's greatest living linguist. And it's not entirely clear to me, and has never been, how Faza ever got himself listed, what sort of evidence he was able to provide. But basically, when you walk around with a number, and he had 56 languages, he apparently had a business card. You know, Ziad Faza, polyglot, speaks 56 languages. When you do that, you're basically hanging a bullseye right on your back. And lots of people, you know, are going to line up to try to take you down. I was thinking recently about the, after reading the big story in the New York Times about Derek Bougard, the hockey enforcer, who was just so large that he would go into bars and people would want to hit them. And that's kind of the way that some of these polyglots end up having to live, you know. And some of them take the challenge. Some of them refuse to give any sort of number, like, how many languages do you speak? Well, a lot, you know, and we don't have time to get into it right now. And some people, you know, they kind of get caught up in the ego satisfaction of it, because it's really gratifying, right? I mean, if you speak a lot of languages, and there's a lot of cultural capital that goes along with that. And you get put into situations where you get tested and you get knocked down. And what appears to have happened with Faza, and I think it was in the mid to late 90s, but he was brought onto a Chilean show and had a number of people show up who were native speakers and asking him questions. You can find this video on YouTube. It's quite dramatic, and you really just start feeling for the guy, because the native speakers are asking questions, and he's unable to answer because he doesn't clearly speak the language anymore. It's not, he hasn't activated it. They haven't told him what languages he's going to be asked in. And the audience is booing and stuff. And you just really feel for someone who seems to have gotten a little bit ahead of themselves. And so among a lot of the hyperpolyglots that I interviewed and in some of the communities that I participate in, just as an observer, there seems to be a real reluctance to put a number out there and to be very clear about what it is that you're claiming when you claim that you have all of these proficiencies. Mm.
Well, in his particular case, do you think that it was that he had just engaged in embroidery upon the truth and padded his resume, or that perhaps there was something about the situation that was a little unfair, was highly stressful, and that it's possible that you could have someone who really did have significant language facility, but if you stress them so much, it'll short-circuit their brain, and maybe, in fact, they can't, at that moment, they actually can't do it. That doesn't really mean that they can't do it.
That's certainly possible. You know, Fazaa has never stepped up to defend himself, as far as I've seen, and to explain the situations. And so, certainly being on television in front of a live audience on live television, that is stressful. And I'd be interested to hear from him exactly what happened. I think that he, you know, was probably someone who was linguistically ambitious and had a certain amount of talent, and then found it convenient in a local sphere to talk about a number of languages, and then that kind of got attached to his name, and he had to live up to that, and that just it put him in a not a physically dangerous situation, but a professionally dangerous one.
Right. Let's take a call here. We have someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi, this is a subject that really interests me. I'm fluent in German. I lived in Germany for 6 years, and I do think in both languages, and I don't translate. However, my ex-husband, who lived the same 6 years with me, his reading ability was better, but his speaking ability was less good, and he would often translate things word for word when he spoke German. Mm. And one of my adopted German daughters did the same thing. But at one point, we had just adopted a second child. We had an American child and a German child, and I would switch mid-sentence, talking from one to the other. But I also found, observing other people, that experience translates and education translates. Like, I would sometimes remember a conversation I'd had with someone in America, and I would remember it in German because I was in Germany. And I observed that the basic education that the guest workers had made a really big difference in how well they were able to speak German and how well they were able to function. The Yugoslavians had a good basic education, and they functioned very well. The Spaniards at that time, this was the 70s, didn't have such a good basic education, and they didn't function as well, certainly in the language. So those are...
Yeah. What's interesting about that last thing that you said, I think there are people who are interested in predictors of later foreign language learning success, and it turns out that one of the best predictors of later success, I think just in terms of classroom grades, is early native language abilities, particularly in literacy. So if you want to predict the grades that someone will get in French as a high school senior, look at the way that they were reading and writing in, I mean, something very, very early, kindergarten or first grade. It's incredible.
Yeah, and that also mitigates against the people that say, oh, we have to educate people like foreigners, you know, immigrants to this country. We need to educate them in English or they won't be well educated. In point of fact, they're
right.
Going to acquire the knowledge, the basic knowledge, better in a language they understand, and it will translate when they're more fluent in English.
And that absolutely becomes a foundation for their, when they undertake English. Absolutely.
Right. So this is a very fascinating subject.
Oh, great. I'm glad you like it. I like it too.
Other people are welcome to call. You'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have maybe about 10, 12 minutes left with Michael Erard. I'm sure that there are people who we could find some other people who would tell the same kind of story, for example, of the caller. Say we have a couple, and they have children. And the couple, they each have a language that they can speak. So what they do is they talk to their children in both languages at home. And we know that children in that kind of environment will very easily pick up both languages and will not have any trouble with it at all. But that then goes to this idea that says our best window of opportunity for learning languages when we're young, and that as one ages, that you lose that. Well, I'm not sure that that's true, or at least we have, I'm sure that you could cite examples of people who learned many of their languages when they were adults, and that their age didn't seem to encumber them at all.
Yeah, so one of the famous hyperpolyglots that I write about in the book is a Hungarian translator named Lom Kato, who was learning her 17th language in her 80s and was very happy to do so. Metta Fonti was learning languages his entire life. And I think the science of learning is, and particularly this interest in the plasticity of the brain, is starting to you push back a little bit on the notion that that the window closes, and then when it closes, it's irrevocable. You know, so certainly, if you wanted to produce an English speaker like me, right? So I don't have an American accent. I have a large vocabulary. I'm literate. I can understand quite a lot of different accents and things like that. You'd have to start very, very early. Now, if you wanted to produce someone like me with my sense of the grammar of English and the vocabulary, but with some accent, you could start later, actually. And if you wanted to produce someone who was like me, who was fluent and fast, who had a vocabulary, maybe had some limited grammar, didn't make all that many mistakes, you could start learning even later, even into what we might call early adulthood, in the 20s. And it's something that happens all the time. It's a very, very small percentage of the population. It's been estimated at, some people say 5%, other people say 1%. But certainly there's a lot of learning that can take place even for adults. But what you have to do is put aside this notion that what you're trying to achieve is being a native speaker or becoming like a native speaker. It's an apple to oranges comparison, because the native speaker that you're comparing yourself to probably only speaks that one language, whereas if you're learning the other language, you need to have bilingual models, not the monolingual model of the native speaker. And I think that that's something that gets overlooked quite a lot in foreign language education. At least it was overlooked in mine.
All right. We have a few other callers, and yeah. Coming down to about 5, 6, 7 minutes left, let's go to Cumberland County, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Interesting show.
Yes.
I attended the Defense Language Institute in the early 90s, and that's my language background. And I was wondering if there's a correlation in any of your learning. Have you found a correlation between social dominance or extroversion and polyglotism or learning new languages? The difference between learning the grammar, memorizing vocabulary, and so forth, and actually using the language for, you know, what you use language for, and getting along in society and so forth. And I was wondering if there's any evidence of a correlation between those things.
So some of the research says that there really is no correlation at all, that personality, that people who are successful language learners and people who are successful language accumulators, that they range across all personality types, and that different personalities would bring different strengths, and people learn how to compensate for things that they're not as good in. I did see something else where someone did, at the Foreign Service Institute, the State Department's language school, had looked at people who were able to attain very high levels in one single language, not in a number of languages, and those people tended to be, or there were more Briggs-Myers INTJs, and so introverts, than other types. Now, there were a lot of things that they brought to the table besides just introversion, but that is one place where the introverts appear to win out over the extroverts. People could argue exactly the other way. What I think DLI should do, because, you know, the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California is the place where the U.S. military does the bulk of its language training. They have massive amounts of data on language aptitude, language performance, and social variables and personality variables, and that would be the question for that research team, really, and I'm sure that they could pull up a lot of really interesting stuff very quickly.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. We're coming down to maybe about 5 minutes. I expect that you can't get into a conversation like this without sooner or later somebody making the observation that Americans are among the most monolingual people anywhere, and that's for a variety of reasons. Maybe that's unfortunate. Now, at the same time, though, I just recently came across an article. I think actually this was in the New York Times, making the observation that what we know about Americans and their language facility, most of that comes from the census, because there is a question that's asked apparently in the census. The question is, do you speak a language other than English? And I think that generally about 20% of Americans say yes. But then there, you have to take that further and say, well, okay, what exactly does that mean? And does that really mean that you're functional in that language? And when you're making comparisons between Americans and, say, Europeans, that's really what you have to ask. And if you do that with Europeans, for example, you start to find, well, actually, they're not quite as multilingual as they're often made out to be, because really their functionality in languages other than their native tongue is often really not that good. So that comes down to this whole question about, okay, are we, as the headline on this story was, are we really monolingual?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was my piece, actually. Did you know that?
Oh, it's son of a gun, Mike. Yes, it sure is. What a dope I am. Was your piece.
I'm glad that you brought that up. You know, I mean, I think that what we need to do in this country is build the cultural image of ourselves as language learners, not as monolinguals and not as bad language learners. And so if you're trying to build an education sector that is bent on assimilating immigrants, then you ask the question that the census asks, which is, what language other than English do you speak at home? If you're trying to build an education system that's focused on global competence, then you want to know the range of language abilities that people have. You want to know where they got them, and you want to know the proficiencies. So, for instance, I wrote this in that piece, that when the census comes to my house and asks, do you speak a language other than English at home, I have to say no, and I get chucked into the monolingual bucket, even though I am a representative example of this desire to become globally competent, because I've gone out and I've studied other languages and lived other places. And I think the picture that emerges there is really very skewed. And I don't know that there are more multilinguals out there, or how many people there are like me. But any increase, I think, would be significant, and it would help to build this self-image that Americans, I think, are going to need moving into the future.
I'm holding it here right in front of me, and it has your name right on the top of it. I don't know how it is I managed to do that. I'm thinking, I read this, and I'm thinking, a really good thing for me to bring up with this guy on the show.
Good thinking.
Good thinking. Yeah, way to go. We're down to the point here where we almost have to finish. I guess, again, one of the questions that your book and this sole subject raises is, if you have an individual, say they're just trying to learn one language other than their own, other than that thing that is their native language, are there some things that perhaps you can learn by looking at people who have this extraordinary ability to learn a lot of languages that can help the person that's just trying to learn one other language?
Yeah, definitely. One thing that they seemed to all share was that they had learned how they learn. And so it's possible to go out and engage experts on what one's learning style and cognitive style might be that would guide one. What's also clear is that they do a lot of repetition. There's just no way to learn a language without a lot of hard work and time on task. But what they do is their brains like to do it. Mm-hmm. So I think for the rest of us, it's find repetitive things that are fun to do. If I were to learn a foreign language right now, I would actually try to learn a musical instrument, but in a language that I didn't know. So I'd be focused on producing piano sounds or musical instrument sounds in a particular way and be developing a language proficiency to go along with that and almost get that as a side thing. I haven't tried that yet. I'll have to, maybe that will be the sequel to to Babel No More.
Sounds like it would be a pretty interesting challenge.
Yeah, it would. And what language should I pick and what instrument? I mean, are there pairs of instruments and languages that go particularly well together?
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that for people who want to read more on the subject. It's a very interesting book. The title is Babel No More by our guest Michael Erard, and it is published by the Free Press. He has written about language issues for many different publications, Science, Slate, Wired, Atlantic, New York Times, New Scientist. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This is a show that we first broadcast on Tuesday, January 24th. All of the programs are there available for you to listen anytime that you like. So if there are some you might want to go back and hear again, or if there are some that you missed first time around, just go to the website, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also check the schedule there. And if you do that, you will find out that tomorrow we'll also have some archives. In the first hour, the guest is Ellen Langer. She's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, and she is a researcher that is often known as the mother of the psychological concept of mindfulness, which has to do with paying attention, defined in a certain way as we go through life. It's certainly possible to go through life not paying attention and still get things done, but you miss a lot. So we had a good conversation about mindfulness and what that means and how we can try to practice it in January. Then in the second hour, this is a show, it was actually that same day. We talked with Lauren Dubois from Duke University about Haiti, in part to mark, again, another anniversary of the devastating earthquake that shook the country, but also try to get a better understanding of the country and its history and how in so many ways the history of the country continues to effect its present, and that is the subject of a book that he wrote that's titled Haiti, The Aftershocks of History. So that's what we'll have for you tomorrow. Again, you can check the schedule by going to the website. That is WILL.illinois.edu.
Illinois public media stations celebrate 90 years of public service broadcasting. To kick off a year of memories and celebrations, NPR congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook will visit the WILL studios. Join Andrea Seabrook and the WILL news team for a wine and cheese reception on Wednesday, April 11. Tickets are $25 a person. Reservations can be made by calling 217-333-7300.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House at Green and Lincoln, 3 blocks from the Engineering Quad. Hendrick House Catering can tailor a menu and price for events from corporate box lunches to weddings, business meetings, and other special events. More information is available at 365-8004.
And that's it for Focus for today. We want you to stay tuned. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices. A lot of red ink today on the screen. May wheat in Kansas City trading at $6.98. That's down 7.5. The July contract down 6.75 at $7.06.75. May wheat Chicago $6.55.75 down 16.25. July $6.64.25 down 13. May corn $6.66 down 7. July $6.63.5 down 6.75. September $6.02 down 3.25. December $5.70.75 down 3.5. May soybeans $13.69 down 5. July $13.76 down 4.75. August $13.65 down 4.25. September $13.44 down 3.25. May soybean meal $3.71.70 down 2.70. May soybean oil $55.33 down 17. April live cattle $125.70 up 40. June $123.25 up 55. March feeder cattle unchanged at $153.40. Actually, I don't know that that should be. Yeah, that's right. April feeder cattle $154 even down 30. April lean hogs $86.05 up 17.5. Outside markets, April crude $107.58 up 52. The U.S. dollar, 79.44, down 35. The CRB index, 319.08. That is up 115. On Wall Street at last check, the Dow was up 26, the NASDAQ up 24.